Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the latest episode of The Book Spider, which is a podcast that explores various works of literature in as critical a manner as possible. I'm Patrick Barney, one of the founders of the podcast, and with me as always are Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger, the other two founders. Today we're discussing a novel that many hard sci-fi fans consider a modern-day classic, Iffelheim by Michael Flynn, who is not, in fact, related to Mike Flynn, the Trump administrator. So there, guys. Iffelheim tells two main narratives, one taking place from 1348 to 1349, and the other taking place in the present day. The narrative in the 14th century follows Dietrich, a pastor who lives in a small German fiefdom known as Oberhochwald. One night, a terrible electrical storm causes damage in a nearby forest known as the Great Woods, and Dietrich, along with Max, a man-at-arms in the fiefdom, goes out to investigate the next day. To their horror, they discovered that a crippled hypo-spacecraft has crashed in the Great Woods, crashed in quotes because, you know, we don't really learn until later how it could crash. So a crippled hypospacecraft has crashed in the Great Woods, marooning a band of travelers who belong to a species called the Krink, an insectoid race that Dietrich likens to grasshoppers. Some in Oberhochwald respond with fear and outrage, calling the Krink demons. Despite some misgivings of his own, Dietrich begins to serve as a liaison between the Krink and Manfred, the lord who owns the Oberhochwald fiefdom. In this capacity, Dietrich comes to believe that, regardless of their appearance, the Krink are children of God and must be treated accordingly. He then befriends a Krink servant who comes to be known by his Christian name Hans, or Johann from the stars, Johann Stern. And their friendship kind of serves as the focal point of the 14th century narrative. As time passes, a few significant events occur. Dietrich and Manfred, with the help of Hans and some other Krinken, navigate a conflict with the neighboring Lord Falkenstein. In addition, Oberhochwald is visited by numerous travelers, including a Jew, prompting Dietrich and others to think about their own bigotry. Some of the Krinken are also assimilated into the Oberhochwald fief as vassals. Eventually, however, the Krink discover that Earth does not contain all the amino acids they need for their diet, and they begin to die off. In order to prolong their food stores, one Krink kills himself so that his body can be used to provide the necessary nutrient until their hypospacecraft is repaired. Eventually, the craft is repaired, but many Krink choose to stay behind in Oberhochwald because there's a very good chance that the craft may not be able to navigate to the Krink homeworld successfully and that it, you know, everyone will die. After the craft departs, the Black Plague makes it into Oberhochwald, killing most of the inhabitants, and the lingering Krink succumb to the absence of the necessary amino acid. So that's the 14th century narrative. And interspersed with this narrative are present-day chapters featuring characters Tom, a historian who uses cliometrics, and his physicist girlfriend Sharon. Tom is puzzled by the disappearance of a 14th century German village called Iffelheim. Various points of data he has collected indicate that it did indeed exist at one point, but he can't determine why it wasn't resettled after an outbreak of the Black Plague ended. A narrative historian named Judy Cow, who works at Tom's library, puts him on the right track by helping him determine that Oberhochwald and Iffelheim are, in fact, one and the same place, the latter name being a euphemized version of Teufelheim, or Devilholm. This leads Tom to some very odd documents that speak of strange visitors to Oberhochwald, descriptions of whom resemble the Krink. Meanwhile, Sharon is making discoveries of her own. She learns that the 11-dimensional space-time structure accepted by most physicists is not actually correct, leading her to create a 12-dimensional model called Nagy space, Nagy is her last name, that hints at how travelers who wish to go to other worlds might navigate inner space or the folds in space-time created by gravitational forces interacting. Together, Tom's and Sharon's discoveries lead them to a modern-day settlement near the site of Eiffelheim, where they uncover Hans's body, whom Dietrich buried 700 years previously, and they discover the truth of extraterrestrial life in the universe. So that's a fairly comprehensive of a synopsis as I can make it. Anything you guys feel like need to be mentioned as well, that I didn't get to, like something important?
No.
Okay. So let's start with the first question I want to think about is this novel's connection to our two previous podcasts. The last episode we talked about Joseph McElroy's Lookout Cartridge, which, you know, I posited that novel is about the incomprehensibility of communication and how the structure of the narrative reflects that fact. And then If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, I was, you know, I think Johan said that's kind of about love of reading or whatever. But either way, both novels kind of have this, I would say an anti-realist foundation, in that neither book really is that optimistic about our ability to communicate with one another or to represent the world accurately. So I posited this novel as kind of an opposite to that, or a response to that. Like, this strikes me as a realist novel, you know, in the sense that it is more optimistic about how we could communicate with one another. It's more optimistic about representing the world accurately, which I think is super interesting, given that a large portion of the narrative is told from the framework of a scholarly person, not the framework, told from the viewpoint of a scholarly person, Dietrich, whose worldview is pre-Enlightenment, just kind of coming into, not yet coming into a modern view of the cosmos. So there's a couple things, though, that puzzle me. So the first is this kind of really awesome tragic irony in the novel, where when Dietrich first mentions to Hans that he can help get him home, like, in, you know, in his, from his viewpoint, you know, he's talking about Christian salvation, that salvation through God, all, you know, is possible. And but Hans and the others at first, you know, take this to be a literal thing, like they can literally get home through this hair of the stars, hair being H-E-R-R, the German word for chief or lord or whatnot. So I'm wondering, does this tragic island irony or anything else in the novel hint at any anti-realist underpinnings that I'm missing out on? Or are we confident in saying this is more optimistic than our previous two podcast episodes about communication?
I would say that it's, you use the word optimistic there, and that's actually a word that kind of was bouncing around in my head. I don't necessarily think that it I think you might be more familiar with theoretical structures defining the, you know, the meaning of the word realist than I am. But I think that it can be realistic to portray fundamental misunderstandings, especially when those fundamental misunderstandings are attempting to bridge such vastly different ideas of what's going on. And so I don't necessarily think that disqualifies the novel as realist. What I do think is sort of interesting is how optimistic the novel is about how Christian faith guides Dietrich, even Joachim, but ultimately the citizens of Overhockwald to really actually step up and represent humanity very well on the whole. Like we're you know, we would be very lucky. We would be extraordinarily lucky to have aliens land in Oberhockwald and then be judged by how they treat the aliens. The novel does seem to be optimistic about how a particular attitude toward Christianity can shape and guide a very humanistic response. And humanistic is obviously kind of loaded here because we're dealing with non-humans, but I think that, and I value Dietrich as a character and the characters around him who ultimately do step up and take care of the Kranken. I do value that as a form of humanism, and that humanism is supported and guided and fueled by a kind of Christianity that I think maybe I may be cynical about and find not totally realistic.
Sure. So if maybe if we're maybe if like the question is framed incorrectly, like realist versus anti-realist as opposed to optimistic versus pessimistic, does that ring more true if we say Lookout Cartridge and If on a Winter's Night a Traveler are more pessimistic than this?
Well, that's a pretty broad-based. I
It is
mean, you'd
broad.
probably want to be specific about what, right? I mean, I don't know that.
Communication.
Okay, communication in particular. Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is. I think Lookout Cartridge is certainly. It's very hard to avoid the idea that it's pessimistic about communication. If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, I think, is maybe interested in different forms of communication. It's not, if on a Winter's Night, a Traveler doesn't seem to be very interested in the communication of rational ideas or clear narratives, right? And I mean, I think it's more interested in a kind of like intuitive or emotive communication. I mean, I think as far as the optimism of communication in this novel goes, you know, it's rooted in a very scientific viewpoint and worldview. And I think of science as being actually very optimistic about the possibility of communication, right? Because like the one of the underlying ideas of science, or one of the kind of, I don't know how you'd frame this exactly as if in meta terms, but like one thing that I hear a lot about science is that science does, in fact, provide a universal language, right? These verifiable, measurable, consistent constants provide not just something that bridges human language, but you know, when people talk about first contact, the hypotheticals of first contact, one thing that's talked about is the idea that, you know, if you can, like, if you get a signal from the stars and it contains a mathematical equation, you know that that is the, you know that that's coming from an intelligent being. And in the, I mean, I think like Carl Sagan's Contact, there's if I remember right, I think that there's kind of an idea there of language essentially kind of a shared language proceeding from the framework of mathematical equations.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, I think that just the nature of science is such that it is optimistic about the possibility of communication. And I think that comes into play here as well. For instance, the moment when Sharon realizes that there's a drawing of a circuit, the drawing of the circuit that's found in the artifacts from Oberhochwald is similar to the circuit that she has designed, right? There's some meeting of there's a meeting of intelligences that occurs there because of a shared understanding of scientific concepts. So, yeah, I certainly do think that this is more optimistic about communication. There's a fascinating kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a running joke exactly, right? But, like, there's a habit that the characters have of, like, when the English character, well, not English, when the medieval characters are applying names to the technologies that are given to them by the aliens, or concepts that are given to them by the aliens, they have a habit of kind of coincidentally stumbling upon the modern word, right? Like microphone. They come up with the word microphone. They come up with the word circuit. I mean, now granted, you know, this is, I mean, there's the implied translation from German because these are all medieval German speakers, but still, there's an interesting trick where they happen to, by describing these new objects in the most thoughtful way, they happen to arrive at contemporary terms for them, even though they don't have our contemporary understanding of them. And that also, to me, kind of suggests an idea of science as offering, science or rationality as offering a kind of opportunity for a clear-eyed view of the world that increases the possibility of communication.
Definitely. Yeah, that's, super, super interesting, fact, like that running joke that you picked up on. They don't come up with the modern word for bacteria, but they do call them small lives towards the end, which is, interesting enough. So, thinking about the optimism of communication, the optimism of science, the way you put it, Hans, definitely makes me feel like it's too optimistic or too aspirational, but that doesn't bother me too much.
If you can be too aspirational, right? Being aspirational is good.
Yeah.
Being optimistic might be, you can be too optimistic if it distorts your view of the world. I don't know if you
right.
want to be too aspirational. Sorry yeah, to right, be right. nitpicky, yeah. but
no, that's fine. I'm glad that you were more precise than I was. So there are a couple of things that I think we want to talk about in relation to this optimism. And so is the optimism of the novel Lost, if we lose the contemporary narrative, which to my mind strikes me as much less interesting and just much less well done than the 14th century narrative part of the novel. Like, I feel like the 14th century narrative is well characterized, well written. It like takes its idea and follows it all the way to its conclusion. But then we've got this messy contemporary story starring Tom and Sharon and some other characters. Do we lose the optimism of the novel if we lose this? Do we lose anything else? Like, is this contemporary narrative worthwhile?
I think the contemporary narrative makes it, and it's I think it's inevitable. I think Iflheim is perfect prestige TV. Like, it would be an awesome, you know, 10 episode series on Netflix, or maybe 20 episodes over two seasons or something like that. And The thing that turns it into prestige TV is that modern frame. But as a novel, I don't think we lose anything taking away the modern frame.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Like, why would it work specifically for what, like, prestige TV, but not for why does it not work as well for the novel?
So I think there's like two levels of closure in the novel, or the two levels is the wrong way of putting it, but there's two ends, and the closure for Dietrich and Hans, and is it Theresia, his adopted kind of charge, is really bleak, but still very, I think, hopeful. I think you don't lose the hopefulness, because you have nonetheless seen this very odd couple come together and form strong, meaningful relationships based around, you know, philosophical inquiry, but also taking care of each other. And it doesn't work out that they are saved, you know, by any of this.
Right.
But, you know, it's enough. You know, what they have with each other is enough at the end to make, you know, I don't know, like, by the measures of the novel, they have given their lives meaning by caring for each other. And then
ultimately we're all going to die, but if we have behaved with dignity and meaning and grace, then we have saved ourselves, even if we do not save ourselves in the literal sense of getting off Earth and back to the Krinken homeworld.
Yeah. I think the translation, I think that works in a novel format, and I wish that that was, I really do wish that that was all the novel was. But if you're looking if the modern frame didn't exist in this novel, and this novel were optioned to be turned into a television series, the modern frame would be created for this novel. And because it gives the opportunity for the second layer of closure, which is the decision to the opportunity to return Hans's body to the Krinken people in the future, that is perfectly fine. It's perfectly, you know, like, warm and good, but it has, that is like the 14th century story is about, or not, it's I don't want to say what it's about, but like, I don't want to diminish it in that way, but those humans and those Krinken do not have control over their situation. And the modern frame is looking forward to increasing human agency and increasing technological and scientific prowess and human control over their environment. That I'm just not as moved by, but I think is,
right.
It's, I don't even know if the word is patriotic, but it is very much like, look at what we will become. And I think that that's a more
modern TV audience just can't end a series with the death of of the two main characters. Like, we just can't, like, we can't handle that. Is that part of it? Like, you know, I didn't watch, whatever it was, that medieval show.
That one show?
I didn't watch it, but I know there was a huge uproar because, you know, one of the main characters dies and the other one is, like, sent off to, you know, the wilderness to be marooned forever or whatever.
I don't even know what show are you talking about?
Game of Thrones? The Witcher?
Yeah, Game of Thrones, right?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't watch Game of Thrones?
I did not.
Oh, I had this memory of you being really excited about it when it came out. I've never watched it. I've never watched the second episode.
No, I've seen one episode, and, like,
Did read the books. Okay.
I read the first three novels. I haven't read any others. And I quit reading the novels for the same reason I didn't want to watch the TV show. It's all blood and violence and rape and it's just misery. I know that this novel is depressing in a way, but it's much more, like, it's a humanist novel. It's optimistic about humans, what humans can be and what, you know, it's optimistic that humans can be positive, and I don't see any of that in Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is just, let's rape and kill and slaughter and cut off people's privates and do all sorts of horrible things.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
You just laid it out. The 14th century frame is optimistic about with how we can react to a situation, to situations outside of our control, with empathy and kindness.
Right.
Even when we're deeply scared and uncomfortable. And the closure to that being, you know, as Hans said, that, like, it doesn't work out in any way that we could ever measure. You know, it's hard to kind of talk about, you know, the things that the positive aspects of the relationship between Dietrich and the Kranken without kind of sounding a bit Hallmarky.
Right.
But it strikes a really nice chord at the end that I think is a form of closure that a novel does better than a television show. And the modern day frame is the television show ending. Like, that's the,
okay.
Or it's the, it's not even the television show ending. It's the television show season ending that is like, and then next season, you know,
right.
Like,
and then next season they invent some complete bullshit and then sell it to you.
Yes.
Next season, the modern day humans get stranded on the Kranken planet.
Oh my God, Hans, that's exactly it. Oh my God.
That's probably what happens. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean,
okay.
From a craft standpoint, I was just going to say, from a craft standpoint, I mean, I don't think that the modern day sections are at all necessary thematically. And I think that you could have something. I think if someone were to read the medieval sections in isolation, I don't think it would occur to them that something was missing, right?
Right.
I can understand the goal of the modern day sections from a craft standpoint, where you're doing a couple things, I think. For one thing, you're creating a clearly defined mystery, which theoretically could impel readership. You know, like, you begin with the question of why did nobody ever return to this village? And then, you know, we are then given the answer to that question. Obviously, there's some suspense in, you know, a giant mantis aliens, giant grasshopper aliens land in a medieval village. What will happen? There's some native suspense in that.
Right.
But it seems like there's an attempt to build some additional suspense above that. But that's one thing, I think, right? And then also because tragedy is foreshadowed at the beginning in the tragedy and the death of all the main characters is foreshadowed in the beginning in the modern sections, it perhaps, as readers, we're perhaps more prepared for the possibility that, you know, nothing will come to these characters beyond death of the plague and being stranded far away from home.
Right. Okay.
I mean, and I think that, like, there's just, I don't know, there's just some, I can imagine, even though they're not structurally utterly vital, I can imagine the modern day sections just kind of being done better, right? Like,
yeah,
there's
no,
some
I agree
kind
completely.
Of, there's just a big, there's a big gap in tone that doesn't quite work.
Right.
And in the, maybe this is too nuts and bolts and, you know, it doesn't matter to the ultimate quality of the end product. My sense from reading, there's like a few pages at the end where he kind of talks about, you know, acknowledgements and the research process and all that. My sense from the end is that the modern day sections went back several years earlier as a freestanding short story. So
even with
revision, it seems like there's just some kind of, you know, he began there and wrote that a few years earlier. And even with revision, he couldn't iron out the kind of tones
right.
of a younger writer working on a less serious project.
Right. Yeah. That's the short story was published in 1986. And then the full novel, Eiffelheim, was published 20 years later in 2006. So,
oh, geez,
yeah, I definitely think there's some of what you know, a lot of what you're saying in there, Hans, and like they don't seem to fit together in tone. So I definitely think that on that level, the novel is not, you know, it's like that is a craft failure of the novel. Like I would be perfectly fine leaving out the contemporary stuff, and I think if you do, you have like actually a genuinely great novel. If you leave that out, like I think you have, you know, I mean maybe not the standards, some of the, you know, maybe not the highest of standards, but certainly like a well above average novel that is done really well. Without this contemporary stuff. However,
I mean, it's no The Carpathians.
it's not The Carpathians, and oh man, I'm so glad it's not. But however, before we let this issue go, you know, we all seem to agree that it'd be a better novel without this with this contemporary stuff gone, but I do want to talk. I do wonder if the contemporary stuff has anything to say about history or the study of history that's important that we need to think about. So, and this question kind of comes out of the contrast between Tom, the mathematical historian. The novel calls him a cliologist, but like I've never seen that word anywhere else. And the closest word I found to it was cliometrics, which just is a cliometrics being a set of mathematical, statistic, and economic theories or standards that one could apply to history. So, you know, I assume that's what our author means by cliologist. So we've got Tom, who doesn't study narrative history. He kind of studies things that could be quantized, right? Or quantified, not quantized, excuse me. Quantized is a musical term, right? So he studies things that can be quantified. In contrast, we've got Judy Cow, who is a narrative historian, and without her, Tom wouldn't have made any of the necessary connections to that would lead them to discovering the site of Eiffelheim and Hans's body. So is this a comment about history that is reflected anywhere else in the novel? What do we think?
It reminds me of, have either of you read Sapiens by Harari?
I have not.
I've read about it, but I haven't read it.
He makes a point that, and he doesn't use the word cliologist either. He's talking more about how, and I don't have the novel in front of me, but he's talking more about how historians and the study of history seek to explain the bigger events in history using economic or otherwise quantifiable means, mm-hmm. like two tribes or two nation states or two groups of people come into conflict because they are fighting over natural resources. That's something that historians who are using, you know, measurables might say. And that just sort of speaks to how we kind of think about what motivates people. But his argument was that that's not actually shown to be the case. There aren't economic motivators that are clear economic motivators for why Stonehenge or other, you know, massive shrines or, you know, huge, you know, like the pyramids. And I'm really butchering his point, but, that there's a kind of a myopia that arises when you are looking for quantifiable motivators for human behavior in history. Mm-hmm. Even though the study of history tends to err on that side because of I'm kind of grasping here because it's been a while since I've read it. I think because of how we handle peer review and you know. Because of the whole sort of academic machine, everything has to be sort of, we can't just sort of say that a people did this or that because of their religious beliefs. You know, we have to substantiate that in some way. And that tends to err us on the side of relying on quantifiable historical motivators.
Mm.
Is that in the same realm as like trying to, like the Jewish dietary laws, right? You can read people trying to explain the Jewish dietary laws in the context of, well, somebody got trichinosis once and they decided that pork was mm-hmm. dangerous, right? That there are things that one thing that the social sciences tend to do is try to find, the social sciences don't love just saying, well, this is an inexplicable thing that is done just because, right? Like, why do they not eat pork? Well, it's just kind of, there is no way to boil it down to a further root cause. I mean, avoiding trichinosis is like, I don't know if you would strictly call that economic, but it's in the same kind of like action for benefit framework as opposed to action for some irreducibly mystical reason. This is pretty far from Eiffelheim, I guess, but
no, I think that's a good connection. I remember I think the author was Borg, and the novel the book I was reading was for a class on theology, and I remember Borg making the explicit claim or reiterating the claim of another historian that the various tribes of Israel, there were many, many different laws, but the ones that did survive and, you know, passed down the laws that we have today have specifically laws about washing your hands because of how that saved them from the diseases that were spreading around. And there's a kind of a weird paradox there where you're looking for patterns that would explain why certain people succeeded or explain why this or that thing exists or doesn't exist. And it turns out to be pretty easy to rationalize why that this or that evolved or developed trait might have been successful, even if it's not the case, or you know, even if it wasn't intentional, or even if it was just, you know, by you know, chance.
So, do we think this is the kind of history that the novel endorses or disendorses? Like, I know we're talking about how, like, the idea of, like, seeking out explanations for various historical phenomenon, like, it turns out it's kind of easy to do that, like, because it's easy to make patterns. So do we think that the novel would agree with that or would disagree?
Well, it seems like maybe this is too reductive a way to say it, but in this novel, ultimately, history works, right?
Yes. Like, yes.
In the sense that the, you know, we were talking earlier about the optimism of communication, and I think the fact that the application of the scientific method to the historical record leads to discovery of the truth is another version of the optimism of communication.
Sure.
As it exists in the scientific worldview, right? The past can, in some sense, talk to, communicate with the present through the judicious use of science. And you can imagine another version of this novel where... You can imagine another version of this novel where the present tense, where the people in the present, the characters in the present, drastically misunderstand, comically misunderstand the events of history, and there's a dramatic irony in the, you know, we as witnesses to both eras see the ways in which greater levels of study produce actually greater levels of distortion and absurdity. And it almost feels like in 2022, that's more likely the novel that would be written, you know, or somebody who were not working in the realm of hard sci-fi, where science is such a paramount value, you know, someone coming from a more kind of MFA standpoint would probably write that version
right.
of the novel.
There's actually a version of that novel called His Master's Voice by Stanislaw Lem, coming from hard science. And it's not exactly that, but basically a message from outer space is discovered in the novel, and the American government gets a bunch of different scientists and different experts in different fields to come decipher it. And all that happens is that they get together, they try to decipher it, and they come up with a bunch of different random theories, that none of which seems to really be better than any other, and they just end up fighting about it, and it's really quite hilarious. Like, it's probably my favorite Lem novel after Solaris.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring up Lem, too. I have only read Solaris. I haven't read any other Lem. I'd like to. I just haven't really gotten around to it.
Right.
But, I mean, the, you know, Solaris is, if when people do, like, a one-sentence synopsis of Solaris, a one-sentence thematic wrap-up of Solaris, it usually comes down to, again, the impossibility of understanding, right?
Right.
This humans and this planet-sized ocean brain simply cannot, will not understand each other. There's
right.
a certain level of the unknown that cannot be penetrated. And, I mean, that, you know, just as much as what you've described of His Master's Voice, I mean, it that's a version of science
right.
fiction which is completely different in terms of its perspective on the possibility of communication.
Oh, yeah. And I actually, if I'm talking in the realm of science fiction, I actually think Lem's version is probably more realistic, at least if we're limited to the scope of of speaking with another species. I imagine if we ever were to encounter another intelligent species, communication would be impossible, and there would be some impenetrable unknown. Like, that strikes me as realistic.
But Patrick,
yeah,
you think...
I mean, from a cynical... I was just going to say quickly, I probably agree with you just as a matter of native disposition, not because I have any real grounding. From a purely cynical standpoint, I suppose you could also say that in some way it's easier to write the novel where communication doesn't occur. You know, there's to go through all the kinds of levels of puzzle boxing that would be required to plausibly present communication actually happening. It would be a real frickin' headache. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, Patrick, you do believe, though, that, and I think this is maybe, I don't know if you want to go in this direction on the podcast, but, you know, you chose this novel as a, you know, a realist sort of response to the anti-realist.
I'm much more optimistic about communication between people. I like, in the sense that I think that it is entirely possible to communicate effectively. I think it's entirely possible to reach at least some number of truths that are objective, and that we could have a foundation of communication based on those small number of objectively true things. I'm optimistic that that's possible, and I think that the reason it doesn't occur is anti-realist tendencies. I think that the reason people were not able to do this more effectively is because some people don't even think that it is possible in the first place. And I think that's problematic. But whatever.
It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe this is a tangent. It feels relevant, but I don't know if this is a criticism. I don't know if this is a criticism precisely. I don't think it is. But it did strike me a few times that the Krinken, really, all things considered, are not that strange, right?
Right.
Like, their ways are not particularly impenetrable.
Right.
They are very, very analogous to Earth insects. In some ways, they're very analogous to Earth insects in ways that kind of offer a ready familiarity. And then they also are really, you know, 95% human in terms of how they just feel basically like people with a few subtle tricks, right?
Right,
and,
absolutely.
Well, certainly one can imagine, one can imagine the possibility of, like, the gulf here is actually not nearly so great as one might imagine it to be at first.
Right.
They've
it makes
even
sense
basically
to me
got,
that we
you know,
can't
little headsets
with
Google Translate in them, you know.
What'd you say?
A handy start. They've even basically got little headsets with Google Translate built into it, which is a
right.
Very
yeah,
handy
yeah.
Start.
That actually reminds me of a question though. They've got these headsets with Google Translate in them, but they're called Heinzelmunken. Apparently, because Dietrich believes that it's not a machine, it's like some living thing with tiny living thing within the box that translates the words, right? And as far as I know, this mistake is never cleared up. And he, you know, the novel ends with Dietrich believing that these little sprites or whatever are in the boxes. Is there anything to that, or is it just a funny little thing that we enjoy?
Well, I mean, almost everyone in the town dies believing that Jesus will save them, so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't remember how much any of this is addressed explicitly, but if I, you know, I mean, over the course of his relationship with the Krinken, Dietrich comes to a greater and greater understanding of how much of what they do is science and craft, philosophy, he would say, rather than science. But right. Essentially that science and craft are producing effects that might initially seem magical. I would assume, it's not stated explicitly, but I would assume that in some semi-conscious way, he gradually comes to understand that the Heiselmonchan is actually just, you know, science.
Sure.
And
okay.
The term, like, it's totally normal for, like, we have lots of words for things that reflect a somewhat archaic understanding of what that thing actually is,
right.
But the nature of language is such that the nouns remain unchanged.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So any last thoughts? It seems like, you know, we're coming up on the hour mark, and we might as well, like, sum up our last thoughts about Iflheim before we, you know, talk to Chris about what he's choosing next. Like, we could just say, you know, I enjoyed this, I didn't enjoy it, I enjoyed it, but I think that the situation is preposterous and that, you know, human beings will never communicate effectively and will always slaughter, you know, those they come in contact with. I don't know. What do we think?
No, I was tearing up at the end of Dietrich and Hans's story.
Yeah. It's a tearjerker.
Yeah, I was moved. I think it's okay to be totally aspirational about, you know, how we, the standards to which we can hold ourselves using our own infrastructure, our own philosophical infrastructure, like Christianity or Islam or, you know, secular humanism,
right.
You know, however that can be refracted to take care of people in need. I think that that's very beautiful. And
agreed.
if it were made into a television series, I would watch it. And I would also fast forward through the inevitable jumps, you know, 700
right.
years into the future where
Tom and Sharon.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Know, will they, won't they? Or no, I guess they are, but they just, they
don't seem like
the bickering,
it.
The bickering Tom and Sharon.
No,
it's I really liked it.
Awesome. How about you,
Yeah,
Hans?
I really liked it a lot too. I really liked it a lot too. I mean, I don't read a huge amount of sci-fi, but
right.
That doesn't mean I have any objection to it. It just happens to not be something that, you know, I mean, there's essentially more of every kind of entertainment product in the world than anyone could ever realistically approach, and
right.
You know, I just don't happen to touch a lot of sci-fi, and I'm not particularly, you know, you have to kind of, like, it takes a certain amount of, if you just go to the bookstore and grab a sci-fi novel, right, maybe you get this or maybe you get, you know, Heinlein or something, right? So, like,
yeah,
I'm not particularly, I haven't put in the time required to suss out the stuff like this that I would enjoy from the stuff like Heinlein that's just, you know, kind of horse shit. But
yeah, yeah. No.
Popular horse shit, but
I
horse
agree.
Shit nonetheless, you know. So, I really liked it. I think we're pretty much all on the same page as far as what we perceive the strengths and weaknesses to be, but the weaknesses as such are pretty easily forgiven.
Yeah. Okay, Chris. What are we reading next?
I was considering a plague novel or a pandemic novel. A couple sort of surfaced in my search. One that I had read, Between Two Fires, which I do highly recommend. That is one that I've read before by Buhlmann, and that's basically assuming Christianity is real, but the you know, the Judeo-Christian God and the Judeo-Christian angels and demons are fighting a war in which we humans are kind of ants or not very, we don't really matter to it. And and it's very brutal and very, very good. I liked that novel. I'm not choosing that one. I also came across.
You said it was called. Just to clarify, you said that was Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis.
Yes, it is. Yeah, Zach Galifianakis plays the medieval sort of squire who has to. Interview Barack Obama. No. I do recommend that one. Another one that I came across was that Colson Whitehead novel about the zombies in New York, Zone Zero or Zone One. I didn't choose that one either. I haven't read that one, but I ended up veering away. Though. Yeah, I'm curious. I ended up veering away from that theme, and I chose something that. I don't know if it connects entirely, but Joshua Ferris's And Then We Came to an End. To the End.
Then We Came to the End. Okay.
It's been a while since I've read it, but I saw it on my shelf, and I seem to kind of remember it about a business in trouble. And the people who work there, and that is the connection, is a group of people who are a little bit nervous about the future. So it's not the best connection, but I did want to reread it. So, and then we came to the end by Joshua Ferris.
Excellent. Okay, listeners, this has been the podcast on Michael Flynn's Iffelheim. Hope you enjoyed it, found it interesting, stimulating, or that it helped you think about the novel in a useful way. So, like, if you ever have to write a paper on it or you just wanted to think about it more deeply, I hope this has been helpful. Tune in next time. We're going to talk about it totally went out of my head. If we came to the end.
If on a winter's night, we came to the end.
Yeah.
And Then We Came to the End by Joseph Someone. Okay. Right. All right. Peace out, listeners, and keep the burning fire of hatred for capitalism and any other negative thing like racism or misogyny alive in your heart. Bye. Yep.